It is Monday, October 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Russia suspends an agreement with the United States on plutonium use.
Russia is not pleased with the United States and wants the U.S. to make serious moves to try and please Moscow while all this tension is occurring between Washington and Moscow over the situation in Syria.
Colombian voters reject a peace deal with the country's FARC rebels, and we look at the new film, The Dressmaker, shot in Australia. It's all ahead. Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a decree Monday to suspend an agreement with the United States on disposing of weapons-grade plutonium, citing Washington's unfriendly actions. I'm joined now by VOA's Moscow correspondent, Daniel Scharf. Daniel, what reasons, I mean, when they mention, you know, unfriendly actions, what are the Russians talking about there?
According to the Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, they're talking about political, military, and economic imbalances in the world. So there was a big laundry list of requirements that Russia has in order to restore this plutonium accord between the two sides. Essentially, this is just a real indication of how bad relations are now between Russia and the United States over the situation in Syria. And, of course, we have the backdrop of the situation in Ukraine as well.
Yeah, the invasion of Crimea.
Yeah, the annexation of Crimea, Russia's involvement in eastern Ukraine, supporting the rebels there with troops and military equipment. You know, all of that, of course, has been boiling in the backdrop. But the real problem, of course, that we've seen is the falling apart of the agreement that we thought was reached between Russia and the United States over the situation in Syria and trying to get humanitarian aid into Aleppo. Now we have Russia backing the Syrian offensive on Aleppo that's created all kinds of tensions between the two sides. Very little discussion happening now between Washington and Moscow on trying to re-implement any kind of a peace agreement on Syria at the moment.
Russia also has claimed that the U.S. is unable to ensure the implementation of its obligations to utilize surplus weapons-grade plutonium. What does Moscow mean by that?
Well, basically, this agreement that was made back in 2000 when Bill Clinton was president of the United States was to try and reduce the amount of plutonium that the two sides had that could be used for creating nuclear weapons. And the idea was to take that plutonium and turn it into a fuel for nuclear power plants. So it would be used for producing peaceful nuclear energy rather than the kind that could be used for war. So the agreement was made, and unfortunately, it's run into problems since then. Although in 2010, they renewed it, the U.S. later had scrapped some of the plans for a production facility because of cost issues. There was also safety concerns after we had the Fukushima disaster in Japan. So the cooperation agreement basically stalled. The U.S. was trying to look at other methods that could be used for getting rid of the plutonium. They suggested diluting it, possibly burying it in storage facilities. Russia didn't like the idea of that because they were concerned that it could basically still be used to create nuclear weapons. So there had been a big stall in the process, and Russia blamed the U.S. side for that, for not going forward with creating a production facility to turn this plutonium into fuel for nuclear power plants. So essentially, they're saying the U.S. Failed to do its part of the bargain. But, you know, this had been a problem for a while, getting any kind of momentum on this agreement. And essentially, it appears that the Russians are using this as the breakdown in relations right now over Syria as more or less an excuse to scrap this agreement, to send a signal of dissatisfaction to the U.S.
Daniel, I understand that Russian President Putin made some demands regarding the U.S. What were some of those demands?
Yeah, he made a striking list of demands, actually, including canceling all sanctions against Russia, scaling back NATO troops, troop levels around Europe to the level when the deal was made in 2000. You know, there were very, very serious demands, also compensating Russia for some of the economic loss from economic sanctions, including its own counter sanctions, which was interesting. So, you know, basically a laundry list saying this is you're going to have to you know, scale back troops. You're going to have to cancel all your sanctions against us and give us a lot of money. So a big list of conditions that's going to be presented to the Duma here, the Russian parliament, with, you know, all these demands, which obviously are, you know, not going to be met by the U.S. because, you know, it's a huge list. and the situation is quite serious with economic sanctions, and the amount of money that they would be talking about for, you know, compensation would be, you know, multiple billions upon billions of dollars for economic sanctions and economic damage. So essentially, it's just sending a very strong signal that Russia is not pleased with the United States and wants the U.S. to make serious moves to try and please Moscow while all this tension is occurring between Washington and Moscow over the situation in Syria.
Thanks very much, Daniel. That's VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Scharf. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what is happening?
Lots of talk about Donald Trump's taxes. This is after the New York Times received some tax documents from way back in 1995 that show Donald Trump declared a loss of over $900 million, effectively avoiding having to pay federal income tax. So, depending on what side you're on, either he's a tax cheat or a savvy businessman, and that's the debate back and forth on social media, with a lot of Trump surrogates saying, oh, well, he just took advantage of these tax laws, he was doing everything to be a good businessman, and a lot of Clinton supporters saying that he subverted the system, that he didn't pay any taxes when millions of Americans had to, and they've actually come out with an ad they've released online that speaks to that. There's also this mystery of the documents themselves. It had a return address of Trump Tower. So people wondering who sent these documents, where they came from. It's the political mystery of the moment. Another name that's trending is Yoshinori Osumi. He's a Japanese scientist, and he's won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for his work in autophagy, which is the study of cell degradation. Now, this is an impressive win for him. He looked at what cells happen when they destruct and break down and how they're recycled. But not a lot of people knew what autophagy was. In fact, searches for what is autophagy spiked by 23 times after he won. So people trying to figure out why exactly he won this prize and this remarkable work that he's doing. And then finally, Kim Kardashian, I think she's trending just about every day for one reason or another, but unfortunate reason today, she was robbed at gunpoint by men posing as police officers in Paris who stole $10 million worth of jewelry from her. Kanye West, her husband, actually canceling a concert early, saying there was a family emergency, he had to leave the stage. Interestingly, other than a statement released through their publicist on social media, no comment on social media from these two stars, who are often on social media tweeting and sending out Instagram photos, but they're laying low after this incident.
I think that's kind of understandable.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top stories trending. The Taliban overruns territory in new Afghan offensive. The party of former Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff loses a lot in Brazil's biggest city. The World Bank says cutting poverty requires more work on cutting inequality. And as we heard, Trump's tax returns roil the U.S. presidential race. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The European Space Agency's comet-chasing Rosetta mission ended its 12-and-a-half-year mission on Friday, September 30th, with a controlled crash into comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. Rosetta had been studying the comet since its arrival on August 6, 2014. One of the most significant and exciting findings was the discovery of an amino acid called glycine in its atmosphere. Amino acids are one of the important building blocks that make life possible and are considered to be the foundation of all life processes. As the Rosetta headed toward the comet's surface, it continued to send back information about the comet's gas, dust, and what its plasma environment was like very close to its surface. The spacecraft also gathered and sent back some very high-resolution images of 67P. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at the location of the debate between the candidates for U.S. Vice President. In a surprise result, Colombians narrowly voted Sunday to reject a peace agreement ending the Western Hemisphere's longest-running conflict. The deal, painstakingly negotiated over 4 years between the government and the Revolutionary Forces of Colombia, or FARC, was widely expected to receive resounding public support. But just over 50% of voters said no. Peter Hakim, President Emeritus and Senior Fellow at the Inter-American Dialogue in Washington, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty former Colombian President Alvaro Uribe was a leading opponent of the agreement.
If you look at where the votes, clearly the yes to the peace treaty won in most of the larger cities, many of the coastal areas. It was in the mountainous central part of Colombia that it lost. My sense was that he managed to really drum up votes in where he was a powerful, popular political figure.
Well, he was opposed to the treaty, and why?
Right. Why? He felt that it was inadequate, that the FARC, many of them were criminals. They had committed heinous acts against civilians. And he also strongly opposed the notion that the FARC should be allowed to participate in Colombia politics. He viewed them as really outlaws, criminals, and he just never felt comfortable with the idea of giving parity to the two sides, the government and the guerrillas. He long thought that the government should have done more to impose its will and impose justice on the FARC.
The rebel leader has still expressed his group's willingness to work toward peace after the defeat of the referendum. Does that suggest that fighting will not necessarily resume automatically?
It's just very hard to make any predictions. I've never seen or heard of a plan B. What happens if the country loses? They can't vote against this. It took 4 years to accomplish. Who doesn't want peace? If the agreement isn't perfect, it's better than any potential alternative. And I think the country is really unprepared for this. But I think a portion of the Colombian political elite that participated in the Santos government and in the negotiations and supported this really suffered a terrible loss. I think that it's going to be a very hard set of issues to work through now. What happens next? Some people on both sides that want to sort of continue the negotiations, but there's going to be people on the extremes of both. This is the opportunity to really do in the FARC once and for all.
That's Peter Hakim. He's Senior Fellow at the Inter-American Dialogue. On Tuesday, the nominees for vice president will debate in the small rural town of Farmville, Virginia. Farmville played a critical role in the American Civil Rights Movement. And as the vice presidential candidates arrive, Farmville's own turbulent history of race relations churns in the background. VOA's Steve Barragona reports.
As Farmville prepares for the debate, Chief Prosecutor Megan Clark gets ready for a day in court.
Do we want to talk about another case?
She's the first African-American elected to the job, but she never campaigned on her race, she says.
Some people would go into the dialogue with me of, oh, are you trying to get the black vote? And I'm like, nope, trying to get the people's vote. I'm not going to go down that path.
This number three is me right here.
Reverend Samuel Williams knows that path all too well. He was a student at Robert Russa Moton High School. The school is now a museum. In 1951, Williams and a group of Moton students went on strike to protest conditions at their segregated, blacks-only school. It had none of the amenities of the town's white school.
They had a gymnasium. We did not. First aid room. We did not.
Their textbooks were hand-me-downs from the white school.
A lot of them, pages were missing. A lot of them had racial derogatory expressions. Using the N-word.
Their protest was included in a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court. That ruling declared school segregation unconstitutional. schools were to be integrated, quote, with all deliberate speed.
That means take your time. Admit not right now.
In fact, the county shut public schools rather than integrate. For 5 years, most blacks and poor whites went without an education.
This is a picture of me playing in the band.
Teresa Clark was grade school age when the schools closed. Her mother snuck her into school in the next county. Clark had to memorize a false address or get kicked out.
At that moment, my mother taught me to lie. I had to for survival.
She now chairs the Longwood University Social Work Department. When she had children, she says their education was paramount. It paid off. Megan Clark is her daughter. Reverend Williams said a prayer at her swearing in.
And it was when he was speaking that I got it, because he is a very stoic man, he's a very strong man, and he had tears in his eyes.
But she says the recent police shootings of unarmed black men have been a step backward.
It's like you have a scab that's healing, and that is, it's now festering again.
Even as the term of the first black president ends, Clark says there is still healing to do in Farmville and across the country. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Farmville, Virginia.
This is VOA.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates, and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election, right here on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. A new revenge comedy starring Kate Winslet and Liam Hemsworth, the dressmaker, is open in U.S. theaters. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, Winslet plays a woman who returns home to uncover a tragic secret from her past and to take revenge on the people who sent her away.
Kate Winslet stars as Myrtle Tilly Dunnage, a 1951 femme fatale fashion designer, who returns to her hometown of Dungattar, Australia. Myrtle was the only witness to the death of a schoolmate and is branded a murderer and exiled from the town by the victim's father. Now it's 25 years later, and after spending time in design houses in Paris, London, and Milan, Tilly has returned to take care of her ailing mother, played by Oscar nominee Judy Davis. She also discovers that Dungattar is full of secrets, like its police sergeant Horatio Ferret, played by Hugo Weaving, being a cross-dresser.
Myrtle Dunnage.
Tilly.
You grew up.
You got old.
Sad, but true.
What have I done this time?
Fine leather can be irreparably damaged by moisture and mildew, Tilly.
How's my mother?
Molly doesn't get out much these days. Did anyone know you were coming?
They'll know soon enough.
Kate Winslet says that Tilly is able to find answers to the questions that have haunted her.
I love the writing of it. I love the humor of it. It's really a fable. It's set in a fictitious town in 1950s Australia. And I play a woman who comes back to that hometown of hers from which she was sent away when she was 10 years old, seeking revenge on all the townsfolk. And little by little, she gets it. And it's very, very clever.
Tilly takes her revenge by trading magnificent couture dresses for the women of the town in exchange for information. The glamorous gowns seem to have the ability to transform the people wearing them from what they are to what they dreamed of being. Tilly also strikes up a relationship with Teddy McSweeney, played by Liam Hemsworth. Hemsworth says that his character helps Tilly to find out the truth about her past and the alleged murder.
My character sort of allows her to to relive that and bring her back to that moment and figure out what actually happened. Because I think because it was so traumatic, she's blocked it out for so many years and doesn't really understand what's happened. And he somehow, I think, allows her to open up and relive it and remember what happened.
Director Jocelyn Morehouse, who returned to the director's chair after a long hiatus, says that Hemsworth and Winslet had wonderful chemistry on the set, which helped make their film roles even more believable.
They were just so fantastic together on set. They were really generous to each other, and they loved the fact that this was a sort of older woman, younger man romance.
Morehouse says a designer friend of hers once told her that couture is a weapon, and that made her want to direct The Dressmaker. She said she was attracted to the storyline in which a skilled woman uses those skills to design clothes that transform people and then to use that as a weapon against those same people. The Dressmaker is based on the best-selling novel by Rosalie Hamm. It has won several Australian awards, including 4 ACTA trophies, the Australian equivalent of the Oscars. The film is rated R for brief language and one violent scene. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Iran's human rights record, as the U.S. State Department's most recent worldwide report noted, remains dismal, despite rhetorical changes from government officials who pledged to restore and expand freedoms for the Iranian people. Among the violations the State Department cited were severe restrictions on civil liberties, including freedom of the press and expression, executions without due process, and politically motivated violence and repression. In September, human rights monitors called attention to new incidents that are raising concern. On September 19th, Sadra Mohaggeq, social affairs editor of the reformist Shag newspaper, was reportedly arrested by security agents. His computer and phone were confiscated, supposedly on the grounds that he had a relationship with counter-revolutionary media. On September 17th, another journalist, Yoshar Soltani, remained detained in Naveen prison after he was not able to post bail for his release. According to the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran, Mr. Soltani was arrested after complaints were brought against 3 news stories he published. Meanwhile, prominent reformist journalist Issa Sahargiz also remains in prison, though his sentence for the purported crime of insulting the supreme leader was recently reduced from 3 years to 21 months. Mr. Sahargiz was part of the wave of journalist arrests that took place in November 2015 and included newspaper editor Ehsan Morzandarani as well as newspaper columnist Ofarin Chitsoz. Whether journalists are advocating for national political reform or reporting on a local land deal, they are not safe from Iranian prisons, said the Committee to Protect Journalists Middle East and North Africa program coordinator Sharif Mansour. We call on Iranian authorities to stop arbitrarily throwing journalists in jail and let the press do its job. President Barack Obama has said that all nations, including Iran, are stronger and more successful when they uphold human rights.
A free press that can expose abuse and injustice makes a country stronger. An independent judiciary that upholds the rule of law and free and fair elections so that citizens can choose their own leaders. These are all the rights that we seek for all people.
President Obama said the reason the United States speaks out for these rights is not because we think our own country is perfect, no nation is, but because we believe human rights are the birthright of every human being.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.